What is going on, everybody? It's your boy, Big Dave Martell, back here again on another episode of The Bog, every single Thursday at 9 p.m. Eastern here on the Dave Martell channel, which you should like, subscribe, share. And also, this is probably our last show on YouTube. I will continue to upload these episodes of The Bog for you guys, but we are going to switch to DLive for our live streams, which I will have a video up in the next couple days or week or whatever to let you guys know where to go, where to subscribe. If you don't have DLive, go set that up after the show here, but we have a really, really great episode. Like always, I have my co-host Tristan, and I'm just going to introduce everybody down the line. These guys are members of the Neurona Society Combat Circle, and they're going to tell us about their project within the Neurona Society, which is called THREMA, an entire martial arts system based off of authentic European martial arts. And then with us tonight, I'm going to go down the line and introduce everybody. Everybody already knows the Folkish Farmer. He is going to be our grappling expert from the Combat Circle. We have Mr. Dave, who is our striking expert. He's the project manager over there at the Combat Circle. And then also we have our good friend, Mr. Corey, who is the HEMA expert over there at the Combat Circle. So how are we doing tonight, fellas?
Doing good, man.
Excellent. Great.
Excellent. So we're gonna get right into it here. Mr. Dave, you are the project manager of THREMA. Give us an overview of what THREMA is, of the Combat Circle. Just give us the whole deal here.
All right. Well, the Combat Circle, when I came into the society in March 2019, it was dedicated to creating a martial art that was based off of our European heritage. In many cases, many people associate martial arts with all Asian arts. And this is really not the case. Every culture had their own martial art. So we took things, we're looking at striking arts from various places. We're looking at grappling arts from various places in Northern Europe. We're looking at weapons such as swords, shields, all the ancient weapons, and then trying to figure out what we're going to do with them in our modern times. And the more studying we did, the more, you know, we learned about that, you know, each culture, if you break everything down into the bare basics, the body moves only a certain way. So, you know, all the arts are the same. What they're colored by is their cultural veneer. They're colored by how their culture developed. You know, what was around to make weapons, what they had, clothing styles, you can go on and on. So we decided to take all this and put it into a system. Now, before I came in, Mark said they were going to call the system THREMA. Now, THREMA is the name of a Valkyrie. So that is apropos, since they were some badass women and goddesses, you know, working for the gods, you know, working for Odin. So we kept the name, and then we started building it up and trying to kind of codify it. So what we did was we took THREMA and we decided on four cornerstones. The first is grappling. It's the first cornerstone that everybody learns. Now, you know, Folkish will give you the definition of grappling, as we put it, but basically it's any time that you grab onto each other or make contact with each other in such a way you're holding onto each other. Most fights end up in that position. No matter what they are, in the street, battlefield, whatnot, you're always going to be grappling. So that's the first thing we teach. And in fact, for grappling, our ancestors, that was how they taught their children. Their children at, you know, 4 to 7 years old were starting in grappling. And they were, you know, keeping it age appropriate, so to speak, for that time. But, you know, they weren't striking, but they were learning how to get over certain things, closeness. You know, they didn't have any issues of personal space back then. I'm sure they did, but they didn't call it the stuff we call it. So they'd learn how to grapple, and as they got older, they kind of put strikes and kicks into it. And then when they were, you know, of age, they'd be given weapons, and they'd start to train with weapons. And it all floats together.
Very cool.
And, you know, so our cornerstones are grappling, pugilism, which we call stand-up. You know, we're talking about anything from elbows, punches, kicks, anything you got, kind of like what you do in MMA. Then we have our weapons forms. And then the spiritual side is one of those things that it's going to take really multiple circles in the the society to help us with, because we're going to develop, you know, warrior ethics off of the nine virtues, but we're going to tailor them towards, you know, what it means to be a warrior and a protector, and to avoid the nine virtues, vices, and also to work with Galdercraft and rune staves and different forms of Germanic spirituality, which will lend itself to the warrior arts and also help people become, you know, physically fit, spiritually fit, and in shape. Because right now, you know, even speaking for myself, I've gone out of being in really, really excellent shape. So I'm working on building that back up. And, you know, we need that, because we need to live for ourselves. We need to live for our families. We need to live for our children and have productive, active lives and do what we need to do for the gods. So that's the premise of it all.
And now, you mentioned focusing on the Northern European martial arts of, you know, like from the medieval period and the Victorian era and that sort of thing, in comparison to the Eastern traditions, which most people think of today. Now, when we think of the Eastern traditions, like, say, karate is Japanese, I believe, and a Japanese man is, you know, 5'4", 130 pounds, a big strapping German lad is significantly bigger. Does that biological difference impact the way the martial arts is shaped and formed?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You have to look at the genetics of the thing. You know, we're bigger people. We're broader. So if you look at an Asian, and I come from a background, I used to teach Chole Phut Kung Fu. So, you know, if you look at the way the Asians move, they're more round, they're smaller, they're smoother in certain movements. Our bodies are more square. So our fighting style lends more to what our bodies are naturally able to do. And then you're also working on different dietary things, different climates, because, you know, we have to eat differently because the climate's different. Now, northern China, it's freaking cold in certain areas. They're pretty big dudes. They're not little tiny dudes. When we ran into them in Vietnam, they were, you know, they were big and they were bad and they were tough. But they're more akin to what I'd say Mongolians would be, you know, that kind of body structure. They're tall, they're husky, they can be tough. So a lot of
And I believe the Mongolians also have quite of a traditional system of grappling. That seems to be something that, you know, the bigger, squarer dudes, you know, you really grab someone, they seem to emphasize that in their martial arts.
Now, well, yeah. Mr. Dave, I had a quick question for you. Now, you are the project manager. Would you mind filling people into kind of what your background is in developing this expertise? Because I know you have quite a few different areas of experience in martial arts. If you want to kind of give people an overview of what your credentials would be.
All right. I started training in 1984. So I was about 14. I started training in Shotokan karate. Hung out there for a while, got a black belt. It just wasn't for me. And then I checked out other systems. So I went to Taekwondo and went through the belt ranks, didn't get a black belt there. I kind of went around. Then I started training in ninjutsu when Stephen K. Hayes started putting out material and different, you know, people were instructing for him. So I did that for a number of years, got a black belt in that years ago, and fell in love with the Chinese arts. I spent about 10 to 15 years working on that. And in 2001 or 2000, I went out to San Francisco and I trained and tested under Grandmaster Doc Phi Wong of the Plum Blossom Association. So I could become an instructor. And I ran a school in Venice, Florida for approximately 4 years before I moved to Georgia. So I've been around. I also studied a lot of the things that came out about real world self-defense. You know, just defensive stuff. So I worked with the SCARS program for a long time. I can't remember the acronym off the top of my head. TFT was coming up off of SCARS. And they're actually very good combat programs. A lot of people laugh at them, but the training is sound. I've had a little bit of experience with Sistema and generally different military combat arts. I spent time in the National Guard, in Georgia. And I worked as a subcontractor for a long time, and I was also an NCO. So I trained troops at Fort Stewart in hand-to-hand combat, different things with the Georgia State Guard. And I've also trained troops for combat lifesaver, near far ambushes, most of the stuff they're going to have to deal with in combat to send them to deploy. So I have a pretty big background in different arts. And then I fell in love with the whole HEMA and European arts, because I'm bored. It's just that we have a rich history, and it's not really hard to learn. It's just how far are you willing to take it in your training. That's pretty much it goes. So that's my background. And for the project in the circle, what I just kind of do is, you know, I don't know how other project managers work. I don't have a lot of problems. I have some great people. So we come up with ideas. Here's what we're going to do. Here's the cornerstones. Here's this. And everybody puts their 2 cents into it. We put it together. We do the research and bang, put it out there for us.
Very cool. So you mentioned the four corners, which would be pugilism or stand-up. Then you have grappling. You have weapons. And then you have the spiritual aspect, correct?
Yes.
Very cool. So my buddy, Mr. Folkers Farmer, would you mind telling us a little bit about the grappling stuff a little bit?
Sure. I mean, to be honest with you, most people think that grappling, if you look at it from UFC or MMA or something like that, most people think that grappling is Brazilian jiu-jitsu. Maybe they know a little bit enough to know some of that comes from judo, but, you know, the wrestling aspect gets totally, you know, left out. So just to let everyone know, I mean, my background in grappling, I was a state champion wrestler, Division 2A. So not a big school, but I was from a rural county. So, you know,
state
that was
champion,
my wrestling
state
back
champion.
In.
That's so pretty cool.
State champion, yeah. Still state champion, even if it's a 2A small podunk school. But hey, you know, I did make it through the ranks and stuff like that. I did some collegiate wrestling in college as well. And then I've got a black belt in judo, and I have a purple belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And I've trained with Elias Seneco, Eddie Bravo, you know, various people in those kind of ranks. So that's, yeah, those are my kind of background. I was very fortunate. I used to travel a lot for work, so I was able to, you know, train with these people, and, you know, it was, you know, super cool. So everyone thinks about that as being the mastery of grappling. Dave, if you've got some of those slides there, maybe show that first slide to the audience there. So what we're looking at is a plate, and this is from Codex Waldenstein. It's a German plate, and what it's describing basically is a double leg takedown. And what I've done is I've broke it down amongst a couple of other arts here. So you can see that I've got folk wrestling, BJJ, MMA, and judo as to how they essentially do a double leg. Like Dave alluded to earlier, the body only moves in so many ways. If you go to the second slide there, this is essentially a sprawl. Sprawl is a defensive technique if somebody's shooting in on you, especially like a double leg, single leg kind of thing. So when you look at that sprawl, yeah, folk wrestling, BJJ, judo, MMA still do it a little bit differently, but we had that same technique. If you go into it even more, probably the best living art that we have right now that the Vikings would have actually practiced, and even probably into probably the 2nd century BC is what we're looking at as far as, you know, some of the origins of this is Glima. And Glima is very similar to judo. If you look at Glima and the movements and the way that they actually move is very similar to judo. So it's based upon throws, whereas BJJ is more groundwork, right? It's to get the opponent to the ground and then manipulate them for a choke or whatever. Judo is more about the throw. So is Glima. Glima is more about the throw. So much so that the rule set for each one of these arts really have to come into play. So when you look at Glima for a rule set, and this is what we take into Threema, and I know that's kind of a mouthful, but what we take into this is that we want to break down and throw the opponent by being able to get back to our feet. So the rules of Glima actually score points for you to be able to get back to your feet, and that's actually how you win the competition. Whereas BJJ focused more on the ground technique. Our ancestors were more into throwing you to the ground and kicking you, stomping you, and moving away, which is more what we're trying to put into Threema, if that makes any sense.
Absolutely.
Now, Farmer, when you say that you know, there's the big difference here between BJJ and judo with throws and the groundwork. How practical is the groundwork aspect to like a modern street fight? Like, if I meet you in the parking lot of Denny's and you start rolling on the ground, is that actually practical outside of a ring?
So a few things are right. So you can't throw the baby out the bathwater on this one. If you went in and you're in a street fight and you thought that you're going to be able to take someone down to the concrete or the pavement, and you're going to be able to roll around with them for a few minutes and, you know, submit them. Yeah, it's possible, but you're going to have a lot of road rash. It's going to be pretty nasty. There's a lot of things like rocks, gravel, sand, tire, whatever's laying around that you could be stabbed with. It's not practical in the sense of rolling around on the concrete. Now, are some of the, like, chokes and sleeve chokes and, you know, throws that are in BJJ practical to a street fight? Absolutely. But, I mean, I would not, even though grappling is my thing, I'm not a very good striker. If I was in a street fight, I would use grappling to defend myself. But I am not going to try to go to the ground. If I go to the ground, it's going to be for a very short time and get back up. There's no reason for me to roll on the ground. So there are some effective moves in BJJ for street fights, absolutely. But, you know, do you really want to be rolling around on the concrete with somebody?
Right. I've always thought in the modern context, you really open yourself up to getting attacked by anyone else. Because, of course, in modern fights, it's not often a 1v1 duel, is it?
And that's the point. And that's why Gleema, if you look at it, it really stressed the principle of throwing your opponent or controlling your opponent to the ground while you are in a standing position or a superior position. So that's more practical for combat, right? If I threw you down to the ground and I soccer kicked you in the head, that's pretty much it, right? I can deal with your buddy coming to me now. Whereas if I'm going to do, let's say, a go-go pilate on somebody, well, I got to roll them over. I got to put my, you know, leg under them. I got to wrap my arm around them. I mean, it's too much time. I got to roll on the concrete. It's just not practical. I mean, it's a sport application. It really has become a sport. And you see the same thing in wrestling, too. You're not going to do a single leg in wrestling on concrete. Your knee will be, like, chaffed up like something awful because you drag your knee across and your leg across, and you're in a low position. Then you stand up into, like, a higher position to, you know, throw the opponent. If you did that on concrete, I mean, you just basically, like, running your leg through a cheese grater.
Now, and there's ways around that, too. I mean, you know.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And that's what we're teaching, the stand-up part. I was going to say that, man. You put your knees on that ground on concrete, your knees are very, very fragile things. And I'm too damn old to get down that far.
So, as Mr. David was mentioning about the four corners, I know Mr. Corey's been over here. I'm going to get over to him real quick, and then we're going to go back to Mr. Dave. One of the corners is weapons. And Mr. Corey, you have quite a bit of experience with HEMA. Would you mind kind of filling us in on your background with HEMA, what HEMA is, and how it pertains to THREMA?
Yeah, sure. I started off, I was, let's see, 16 years a sport fencer, just regular traditional fencing, and kind of got frustrated with it because it completely abandoned defense in any sort of respect. And that didn't make any sense to me as a, whatever, as somebody who loves messing around with that sort of stuff. So I went, and I started hearing about this thing called HEMA and started working through different manuals. I personally have gone through Lichtenauer and Fiore di Liberi, and I haven't quite finished all the Manzano stuff, but well, I may never anyways, but anyway, so how that applies to, THREMA. So basically what HEMA is, that this is a sport, so it's a lot like fencing, but it's using traditional historic European weapons and styles based off of the manuals that were left to us, starting with I-33 and going up to the 1900s. The First World War, they're still issuing sword fighting manuals, interestingly enough. Anyways, wow. That's the time period that HEMA sort of covers. How that applies to us, there is a wealth of information about how our ancestors fought left behind in these manuals. While HEMA is a sport, what we're looking to do is teach. If you want to learn that, that's fine. That is out there and available. However, this is more for combat if it's necessary, which nobody wants to get into that situation, but sometimes it happens. Mm-hmm. That's basically where we're taking what HEMA normally is and adding it to the repertoire. It's not going to be the entirety of the HEMA arts, for lack of a better term. Like, we're not going to start off teaching people longsword or halberd or anything like that. It'd be more like canes and knives, things that are more applicable to today.
Right. Cool. I feel like if you're walking around the modern day with a halberd, you probably already won the fight.
You might be right there.
So, Mr. Corey, what all sort of weapons are we talking? You mentioned starting out with things like cane fighting or stick fighting, and then getting into things like knives and short blades and stuff like that. How practical do you think something like sword and board is, or do you think that's something that's just purely a traditional type of thing to learn? What's your opinion on that?
There's sort of two minds you can take on that, and some of that depends on how much dedication you want to put into learning everything. Learning the sword and board technique, say like you were mentioning, or longsword or rapier or things like that, will help you develop the footwork and muscle memory you need to make any sort of other fighting art apply. Cane isn't all that different from, say, a rapier when it comes right down to it. And especially if we were talking sword canes, which are legal in some places, not legal in others. Check your local laws. The advantage to, say, a cane over a knife is you've got a reach advantage, and it is less lethal. Not saying it's not lethal, but it's less lethal than a knife. So you're probably in a legal situation going to be in slightly less of a predicament than if you were to pull out a knife right away, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, very cool. And for people that want to just get into the HEMA stuff, is there a certain weapon that is easier to start practicing with? Is there a certain sport or art, or what could they pick up and use and start practicing with that is going to be involved in HEMA?
That's a good question. For right now, your best place to get instructors are probably going to be HEMA clubs. Most of them start with longsword. If for whatever reason, that just seems to be, maybe it's because that's where the most information is. I don't know. But that seems to be the go-to starting weapon. And I can see why, especially because you start to learn some footwork that you don't learn in some other sorts of areas, traversing footworks and things like that, that maybe grappling has. I'm not the biggest expert on that, if I'm honest. You start to learn footwork to help keep you at a safe distance while still being able to punish your opponent.
Very, very cool. And as Mr. David mentioned about one of the corners was striking. And Mr. David, as you mentioned earlier, you have spent a long time mastering very many disciplines that involve striking. So what are the – because I know we've talked about, you've said you've looked into savate. You've looked into various other, you know, English kickboxing and like all kinds of different stuff. What are the different disciplines that you are drawing from to put together the striking arts for HEMA?
When I started getting into this, I started looking at what source material we had. A lot of the source material came from the 17th, 18th, and 19th century for early era. Pugilism, as it would be called. Now, in the early days of pugilism, from ancient times up till about 1746, was the early era. So this was bare-knuckle boxing. There was no rules, none. So you could grapple, you could kick, you could take your opponent down to the ground, you could use elbow strikes, you could bite him. It didn't matter. You could do whatever you had to win the fight. A lot of times this was done at bars. It was starting to become a, quote, stage event. And from there, you could throw your opponent off stage, all legal. everything was good. They took this from, you know, the pugilism that was developed in Europe, and each country has their slight difference in boxing styles, kicks and punches and different things, you know, and that's how it kind of rolled. That's how we started really working on that. And then when you look at English pugilism, it's all put together. You know, everything was kind of, a lot of people had different styles. So they made, you know, styles were made out of the individual fighter who was good at what he was doing. Then around like 1746, this was after, we can go back to 1719, where a guy named Figg became the overall pugilistic champion of England. And he was good, and he taught a guy named Bart Broughton. Now, in 1746, Broughton killed a guy, or before that time. And a lot of people died in these sport bouts, you know, which really weren't sport. It was just kind of like Fight Club. You know, you went in, bet on whoever you did. It was entertainment. It was really rough back then. And then he didn't like the fact that a lot of people were dying, so he put in certain rules. And the second era of pugilism is kind of like the Broughton period, where you had certain rules, like you could grapple, but you couldn't grapple anybody below the waist. You couldn't hit anybody when they were down. You couldn't throw them off the stage. He also put the concept of rounds in, which are used today, but they were very different back then. A round lasted as long as the fighter was standing up. Now, if you went down on one knee, the round was over. So a round could last 30 seconds. A round could last 2 hours. There was no kind of, you know, set thing on that. If an opponent was knocked down to the canvas, then he had 30 seconds to get back to the mark. And if you look at modern bare knuckle boxing, they put their toe on the line. That's how they start out in the bare knuckle championships. You have to get back to the mark. Then after that, I guess 100 years later, after I guess around 1840 or 50s, Marcus of Queensbury came up, and they started using gloves in their training and their application, which changed the whole way guards were done, because you're no longer throwing bare knuckle punches. We also have to realize that these guys did not go full force back in the day. You know, you can't do that. You can't sit there and punch somebody's head on and off, you know, with everything you've got. You're going to break up the small bones in your hand. Mm-hmm. So in the early ages of pugilism, you had kind of strikes that would go with the palm of your heel that looked like a fist. So you turn it into that. You'd hit with the hammer side. So there was a lot of differences in early pugilism to, you know, middle era to late era. Late era is our modern day boxing. Your guards were held out in front of you a lot farther. This was to achieve distance. And a lot of stances weren't exactly even stances. They used to back leg a lot, so their front leg could block kicks and kick. So if you look at the early days, that's what we put into it. Now, we put in savate. And the reason I chose savate was from Marseille, France. I forget what year. This was 1800s. All the sailors were going into the Orient. And what they were bringing back was kicking techniques that they added to their pugilism, which now savate is basic French kickboxing. Difference is they wear shoes. They wear pretty heavy shoes. So they're still, you know, it's a very deadly art. They use a lot of high kicks. What we did with Threema was we turned everything into low kicks. We don't want them kicking above the waist if they don't have to. If you want to kick a guy in the head, you want to take out his ankles and his knees, and you want to bring his head down to you, down to your waist level, so you can kick it. You'll get more power, more, you know, you don't have to be as flexible. So we've taken those parts of that art. We've also taken whatever we can find that works from Northern Europe, but that's the breadth of the pugilism, which fits right into grappling. You can always get an arm free to hit. So when you're grappling, now we in Threema grapple, you know, we're not going to be punching each other. That's the train. In our training for stand up, we're going to be wearing safety gear. But a lot of this is in various books and various things that have gone around that have been in print. So a lot of great fighters had different styles. Mendoza, he was a Jewish fighter. I think he was one of the champions in England. He was a really small dude. But what he did in the early days when he was fighting in pugilism, you know, his guard was kind of with both hands out in front, and they were up in close, and he used to keep a pretty wide stance, but he kept that stance to be able to move in, grapple, and then hit, because he was smaller. He had to figure out a way. And if you're a bigger fighter, you know, you don't want somebody coming in your inside. It's harder for you to deal with. They can grapple you. They can do a lot of things. So we've taken all these arts and we've looked at modern day and said, okay, how do we use them in the street? Now, if you look at some of the old pugilism stances, they were back weighted and their feet were 12 to 24 inches apart. There's a reason for that. In the 18 and 1900s, streets were cobblestone in England and parts of Europe. And, you know, places that it rained a lot, it was very slick. So a lot of deep stances, it would take your balance away from you. You might slip and fall. So there are reasons that in different places, different ways of pugilism kind of evolved. In Russia, they have a guard, but they do a lot of parrying, you know, a lot of just moving things away and getting off center. And that's where some of your sambo comes in, sistema comes in. They have a different mindset. But the Russian folks are still, you know, they're the Rus. They're still our people. So that's where we're going with that. Round kicks, all of our kicks are natural. We don't look for unnatural ways to move the body. We want this so all ages, all levels of physical fitness can actually be able to be effective. Because not only is it a sport, it is a sport for us, but mainly Threema is an art of self-defense to teach you how to defend yourself, your family, your clan, and your tribe. And that's what it's there for. And it's also to build physical fitness and, you know, rounds of pugilism, training in pugilism. You're getting a lot of movement, a lot of cardio, a lot of good things. And you add in the grappling, which makes our unarmed combat. It's great. And then when you take it to weapons, everything you learn in pugilism and everything you learn in grappling, they go for the weapons. Because what is the weapon? The weapon's your brain. The weapon's not your body. The weapon's not something you put in your hand. Your weapon is your brain. Your body is the thing that does what your brain wants it to do. The weapon is a snap-on tool. So you're going to adapt when you have a weapon in your hand because it gives you longer reach, and there are ways to generate more power. We can look at the longsword. You can look at a longsword, and that's where a lot of your fencing guards and lighter blade work came from, right from the longsword, and evolved into that. So, you know,
now people are asking in the chat here, are you going to be using various Eastern methods in the teaching at all, like Muay Thai?
We're going to look at the Eastern methods and tailor them to us, but no, we don't want to. We want to really kind of keep this as our art for Threema, for, you know, folks of Northern European heritage, to honor all the combat systems that came from our people, the martial arts. So we'll look at things from different arts. And if they're applicable and natural, we may use them and we'll give them credit. But we look at other arts to figure out how to defend against those arts, because there's so many systems being built today that you're going to see out there. You're going to see all the grappling stuff that Dennis does. You're going to see, you know, different stick techniques out of Kali and different arts. And we also have, you know, we also have our staff forms, our cane forms, or applications to these different things. Spears. We have a very complete, you know, well to draw from martial arts, our own martial arts. And that's how we want to kind of keep that.
Very cool. Very, very cool.
So- yeah, I can actually add a little bit to that. You know, when I'm looking through these different codexes and different plates, we had a complete grappling system. So I don't want anyone to think that, you know, we're borrowing from judo or jiu-jitsu or something like that. What I'm doing is comparing them. So I'm looking for different things. And one thing that I have noticed is body types. Body types play tremendously into grappling. Northern European people are bigger and they are way stronger than Asians. And this is why in a lot of grappling systems in Asia, you see a, you know, gentle, more flexible kind of movements. You see this play also into the fact the way they submit people, you know, you have to have some flexibility. It's about timing. It's about, you know, the technique and so on. Whereas a lot of our moves, and I don't, this is not to sound crude or anything, when we went for, you know, let's say a, you know, hip toss, we slammed the opponent to the concrete or to the ground, and we tried to injure them with that throw to be able to then stand back up and deal with, you know, other opponents or whatever. When armor started to be played into this equation, if you look at Asian armor, it was very light. I mean, it was probably like 20 pounds. If you look at air plate mail, dude, we were seriously like 60 pounds in. You pick somebody up, you sling them to the ground, and you put all of your weight and force into that throw, and it's seriously like a minor car wreck. So that is how our grappling system evolved. That's why you see in wrestling these very explosive moves, whereas in judo, you see a more, you know, precision kind of timed flow move. Doesn't mean one's more effective than the other. It just simply is a difference in body type. And that's what we're really comparing to these other arts, is our body type and looking at the way our ancestors designed these moves.
Now, I got a quick question for you, Mr. Folkish. So a lot of people, they attribute modern wrestling, you mentioned collegiate wrestling, which I did some wrestling in school too, and I took a little bit of BJJ, and also took some Sambo. Not a lot, okay. Just like a little tiny bit. But a lot of people, they attribute these moves in collegiate wrestling, or even, because if you watch MMA, every MMA fighter has a Division I wrestling coach to teach them takedowns. It's just, yep, it's just the way that it is.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of people attribute that style of wrestling, what we understand to be wrestling, as purely Greco-Roman. How much of our wrestling that we do in school is from the Germanic arts? And is there a difference between the Greco-Roman and the Germanic arts?
Yeah, so typically what we do in school is what's called folk wrestling. And so when you look at Greco-Roman wrestling is basically waist up. And if you look at the different starting positions that they have, you're either trying to flip your opponent or pick them up with, you know, pure force. So there's a lot more strength involved in Greco-Roman wrestling, whereas folk wrestling, you got, you know, to be able to do the single leg, double leg, you know, ankle picks, various things to where you could shoot below the waist. So it's really two differences. I think that more of it came from ringing, and I have proof to be able to show it. More of it came from, you know, the Germanic wrestling, Schwingen as well. Schwingen is a Swiss wrestling that they do in sawdust. And if you look at that, it looks very similar to judo. It's a very hard throw, though. It's not a soft, you know, gentle throw like judo does. It's a very hard throw. So I don't see the argument at all for Greco-Roman wrestling in that. I see most of that coming basically from ringen and schwingen as to what we do in, let's say, high school or collegiate wrestling. Greco-Roman wrestling is, it's rarely practiced now. It's really sad. I practiced some of it. I had some opportunities to do it. It's a cool sport, but it's really fell out of favor. And pretty much what you see now is what we consider folk wrestling or just collegiate wrestling.
That's very cool. Excellent. So
I wanted to say one thing there really quick for anybody watching this. We're not putting down any art. Not at all. We respect all the arts out there. You know, so we're not running around with the whole ego thing saying our art's going to be the best or the art. What really counts in the combative situation is not the art, it's the fighter. And it's the individual that's defending themselves that uses the skill and how good they are. No one art is better than another. Every art is suited to a different body type. Every art is suited to a different mentality. So as you're going out and training, you know, you may not like Threema. It may not speak to you, and that's fine. That's great. You know, what I say to everybody else is find the art that you actually really like, that fits your body type, fits your mentality, and then train like hell in that, because it's not the art that makes you the protector of the weapon that you are. It's you. So it all depends on your training and how hard you train and everything else. You're the person. When you study an art, in time when you advance, what you're allowing that art to do is come out of you. So the art flows through you. Instead of you trying to practice the art, you become the art. So that's why I wanted to kind of say to anybody else for other arts, you know, we're not in any way disparaging any art from the East. We're just doing our own thing.
Mm-hmm. That's very cool. And I had a quick question for Mr. Corey. Was you mentioned quite a few different like documents and stuff like that when in regards to HEMA. One of the documents you told me one time in a private message, you told me about George Silver's treaties and stuff like that. What are some of the documents people can just pull up if they want to look at some of these ancient styles?
So I guess probably the best resource for that would be there is a website called Wichtenauer. It is a play on the German master's name Lichtenauer with the wiki attached. Anyways, they've got a very extensive collection of those manuals. George Silver's Paradoxes of Defense is an interesting one for modern day applications, even though I think it was 1700s, written in 1700s. In that it covers a lot of staff and cane work. So that's something that if you are interested in applying to right now, you can get that information very easily from places like that. There are, if you look around, I'm sure you can probably find plenty of PDFs as well. How legal these are to share with others is a different story. I'm sure you can find plenty of those around, in a variety of styles. Everything from, the very earliest manuscript that we have is called I-33 or 133. The I is basically the categorization number, for when it was in the library where it was found. And that's sword and buckler, arming sword, just the one-handed, the next sort of iteration of the Viking sword, and a buckler, which is a very small shield. And then going up to, clear up through cavalry sabers in the, in World War One, there's a whole variety of information out there. Unfortunately, art earlier than, say, arming sword, like the fighting styles of the migration era or Viking era, however you'd like to call that, are sadly lacking. We don't have very much information about that at all. If you're interested in that, the best reconstructionists, and that's the only word that we can really use because there are no documents, the best reconstructionists I've seen on that is a fellow called Roland Warshecka. He's got a YouTube channel, and he does his best to reconstruct fighting arts, even going so far as to reconstruct fields to see how those were used, because that's part of the deal too. Like a sword and shield is a weapon system. You're using them both in conjunction to beat your opponent. Your shield isn't just taking hits from the enemy. In fact, it won't last very long if that's all you're doing with it. So, for example, so if you're interested in stuff that's even older than the manuals that are out there, and remember, it's just purely reconstruction. We can't say 100% this is how they did it, but based on the living history that this guy does, which is pretty interesting, and is thinking about it, he's got a few flaws here and there, but in my opinion, but he's a really good resource for that sort of thing.
Very, very cool. So we are starting to get to the end of the show here, but Mr. Dave, I wanted to kind of come back to you, and I wanted to talk about the practical application of Threema as a whole, and also I wanted to ask you, what is Threema going to look like? How are people going to be able to access this at first? And when I think of Threema, like I'm in your guys' chat in the watching all the resources. I'm in all the little groups and stuff, so I get to see all the awesome information and stuff that you're coming together with. And when I envision Threema and I think about it, what I think about at first is really a really cool cultural sport that everybody does. It's like, you know, how everybody knows how to play cards, or everybody knows how to throw a football, or everybody knows how to do like whatever. This becomes us as Sedians, as people of the Germanic tradition, this becomes kind of our cultural sport that whenever we get together, we do some Threema wrestling, or maybe we do some sparring, we fight with some staves, or we fight canes, or just for like a little sport. So it's like people go to big events, or they go to bloats or whatever, and we set up a Threema mat, and we do some grappling and some fighting and stuff. And that's kind of what I envision when we talk about implementing this, because this is very much, in my opinion, a really cool, deep cultural item, a cultural element that's gone on modern people, that we are going to bring back as not just a cultural thing, but a huge portion of our faith. This is the, like, you have mind, body, and spirit. This is the body. You know, I mean, this is the body. Because as you mentioned earlier, Mr. Dave, about how it's you know, it's good for keeping you in shape, keeping you fit, keeping you strong and tough. It's also a cultural sport, as I'm talking about now, but it also makes you able to protect your family in dangerous situations. So for people that are like having the same kind of vision I am, it's like when it's ready to roll out, how are people going to be able to access it? Or is there going to be places people can go, or you can meet with people, or is it going to be videos, or how are we going to learn Threema?
All right. Well, this is the tough part, because we're so far spread out. Okay. This is, so right now we've got to go with what we can. So what we're doing is we're creating a Facebook group, and in this group, we're having discussion topics, and in each topic, we're discussing our cornerstones and things we want people to learn, showing videos from people that have done these techniques on YouTube. And eventually, we're going to get to the point when the society's bigger and different things, we're going to make our own videos for this. So right now, we use what we got. We have a level one, level two, and level three for each cornerstone. And under level one for, you know, say grappling, you're going to learn certain movements. You're going to learn something called the wizard. You're going to learn single leg and double leg takedowns. You're going to learn how to operate and grapple within the clinch. And you're going to learn some basic other takedowns with it. And you're going to go with that. And you're going to practice that. So we're going to have these all set up and organized. Your job as a student is to, if you can, get a training partner that's going to help you learn these moves. And what we're looking to down the line is when we have this, you know, completely set up and rolled out, we're going to have a section where students can work with their training partner. They can film a technique. They can post it up on there, and they can get feedback from our grappling instructor, Dennis, Focus Farmer, myself for pugilism, and Corey for, you know, blade work and improvised weapons and different things. So they'll be able to get feedback. And, you know, the real point of all this is that you learn the foundational cornerstones. And each person, like, let's take Big Dave for an example. Big Dave has his kindred. They start working with this material. What they're going to do from the foundational work is they're going to build their own structure. So the style of Threema is Dave's kindred's name. So they may, you know, learn things about some of the arts. And individuals that practice, they're going to be actually, you know, learning the cornerstones and using what works for them. And as they teach people, that's going to become their style of Threema. So when we all come together, as Dave said, and I couldn't put that any better of a way than he did, that's what we're hoping to happen at gatherings, that, you know, we have a combatives match. We have, you know, a grappling match. We have pugilistic matches. We have these different things as part of our games before ritual and different things. And the spiritual side of it, you know, that's still being worked on. But we really hope to get the bare bones of the system out in 1 to 2 months and open up our Facebook group to members of the society and the public. Now, we're going to have to control the internet. If you look at things, I'm kind of modeling this off of the Gracies have their university online, where you can become a distance learner. And Master Wong out of England has his, he's got his different fighting style that he does. And they do it the same way. They do it electronically. You get a training partner, you work out, you get correction on video, and then you might come out to meet one of the kindreds if you're really serious about testing and gaining rank. But we don't want to get rank specific. We don't want a bunch of levels and belts. What we want you to do is just learn the skills that you need. And the basic levels are very easy. They're for self-defense. The intermediate goes more into combat. So what you learn, the basic level of grappling would be everything you need to know from a stand-up position. And then we're going to take those same moves when we get to intermediate, and we're going to show you how to do them from the ground in any position you're in. And then that's going to, you know, lead towards more. When you start with basic level weapons, you're going to work with a cane. Things that we can take these techniques from the past and bring them into relevance. And in improvised weapons, you're going to learn how to use a broom handle, say with some of the guards that you would see in longsword and fencing, and thrusts and different strikes from different staff work and different things. So we're going to build it into something that reflects our Germanic past, but works in the modern day. So does that kind of cover what you want?
Yeah, absolutely. Big time. That's very, very cool. Combat Circles is probably the one that I get asked about the most because obviously everybody loves all the stuff that Neurona Society does. I certainly do. But Combat Circle is one that's kind of that we haven't really seen a lot coming because, you know, there's been scholars in the past. There's been theologians in the past. There's been people that talk about, there's been musicians and stuff in the past. You know, having a combat martial arts aspect that is purely European is something that is really, really exciting to people. And I get a lot of questions about it. And I know a lot of people are really excited about it. And I think it's going to be really, really cool when this rolls out. I know I'm keeping an eye on it and everything like that. And we are coming up at the end of the show here. However, Mr. Tristan, did you want to hop in here real quick? Do you have any questions for the guys?
Yeah, I would like to ask what the theme so far has to do with the spiritual aspect. Do we have anything built upon that, or are we still in the research phase?
No, I can actually add a little bit to that. So everyone knows when you get ready to go to a wrestling match or something like that, you have the hoorah, hoo-hoo, you know, everyone gets pumped up, right? So there's actually some primary sources about Gleema doing galdering. And to this day, various Gleema clubs in Scandinavia do galdering before they go out onto the mat or to the, you know, grass or whatever to wrestle. So there is some spiritual aspect to it. I know even in, you know, the wrestling club that I'm a member of, you know, we have a, you know, chant that we do before we go out onto the mats. And our ancestors would have seen that as a very spiritual thing going into battle. So we've got some, you know, primary sources, at least from Gleema, you know, on that. So, you know, Dave will speak a little more about it, but at least from the grappling side, there is a tradition that's still alive to this day, actually, you know, kind of getting the spirit riled up and stuff.
I figure we can take some of the stuff from modern sports traditions. I mean, anyone who's ever played football knows that, you know, people often start the game with prayers and invocations and that sort of thing. So is that something, do you think, people would do when they were practicing Threema? Like they might make prayers for victory and strength and honor and that sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I think that that's a part of it. We also want to take... Now, what I've been working on is it's kind of a new project. There's a lot of great warm-ups from Sistema that work with being relaxed. And the whole point about being a fighter is actually you don't want to be tense. You want to be as relaxed as you can so you can get movement, and that works with the breath. What did Odin give Ask and Emble? One of the biggest gifts. He gave him the own, the breath, the spirit. So we're incorporating that aspect, incorporating in the galdering, which will work also off of rune chants. So when the society, we're starting I know that there's going to be a Galdor project starting. And what we're hoping to do is we're going to kind of meld that spiritual section with the Galdor project. And we're going to talk about those things with them. So we can develop, it's not going to be what our ancestors exactly did, you know, but it's going to be very traditional. If you look at the Polynesians, the thing's called hakas that you see people doing videos about now, and it's caught on with, you know, all that kind of stuff. We had our own version of hakas. We had our own version of prayers before, you know, and rituals before fighting. I believe warriors always get together and have, no matter what culture you're in, have some kind of prayer, invocation to the gods to help them become victorious, give them the strength and courage to handle what they need to do in battle. And we're going to work that in. That is a very nebulous project, as you guys can tell. I think in some ways it's more difficult than what we're doing with the putting together the combative system part of it. But, you know, we hope to roll this out very soon, at least the physical part. And as folks start to learn that, we're going to incorporate the spiritual stuff. So it's not going to be a project that we just throw out there and it's done. This is a fighting art. This is something in a sport. This is something that's going to evolve over the years and the generations to come. So it's ongoing.
Yeah.
And I'll probably, and you know, man, I hope that when we're all dead and gone and our future generations are there and we're big and we have schools that teach Threema and we're involved in grappling competitions all over the world, you know, those great masters who train in Threema, their pictures will be up. They'll always be remembered. And that's so important for our culture.
Very cool. Very, very cool. As you mentioned, it's a living tradition. So one thing that you mentioned that I thought was really, really cool was how each clan and each kindred could very well develop their own flair, their own flavor of Threema. So like, say, for example, my kindred takes strong to the grappling aspect or the wrestling or even the striking aspect. And then the Penfolk Threema could be, everybody's like, oh, Penfolk's here. We're going to get a bunch of guys that are going to be throwing kicks and punches. You know what I mean? So it's gonna be really cool how it evolves independently among these different people. And you said it's not something that our ancestors did, but if our ancestors were alive today, it would very much be comfortable for them. It would be it's not a reconstruction as it is a recreation of something authentic. I think would be a good way to put it.
The Norna Society, the whole motto: hearts in the past. You know, minds in the present and eyes to the future. That's exactly what we're following when we develop this system.
Absolutely. All right. We are unfortunately out of time, fellas, but thank you so much, all you guys, for coming on. This has been a wonderful episode. I know everybody's loving it, and I know there's quite a few people that are really looking forward to this, and a lot of people are really excited for what's going to be rolling out from the Combat Circle and from Neurona Society in general. So I want to implore everybody to make sure to go check out the website, neurona.org. Go find them on, we're over on Facebook, where I believe we're on Twitter. We are also on, we are on Telegram. And also, there's a really good YouTube channel, the Neurona Society YouTube channel. And while I'm plugging Neurona Society, get yourself a copy of the Epicist 1, because Epicist 2 is coming in on Ostara. Epicist 2. And speaking of the Combat Circle, Mr. David here, he wrote a big, awesome article for Epicist 2, talking more in detail about the Combat Circle. That's going to be featured in Epicist 2. But before Epicist 2 comes out, make sure you get a copy of this. It's available over on Amazon. Just type in the Epicist Neurona, and it'll come right up. Get you a copy. I'm in here. Tristan's in here. You know, all the really Dr. G's in here. Man, all kinds of good stuff. You guys are gonna love this. You're gonna love issue 2. It's even bigger and better than the first one. It's gonna keep getting bigger and better as Neurona Society itself keeps getting bigger and better, and the bog keeps getting bigger and better. So thanks again to you guys for coming on, man. This has been an awesome episode, Mr. Folkish Farmer, Mr. Dave, and Mr. Corey. Many thanks, many blessings, many hails, and thank you again, Tristan, for coming on, riding shotgun, being awesome as always. And I'll see all you guys next week. Next Thursday, 9 p.m. Eastern, here on The Bog, which is probably going to be on DLive. It's going to be on DLive, so I'll have that information coming out very soon. But many blessings, many hails to all you guys. I'll see you guys next week, 9 p.m. Eastern. Hail.